Section 3, New Issues, An American Story. Thursday, July 12, 1965, was hot and humid in Chicago. That evening, Dessie Mae Williams, a 23-year-old African-American woman, stood on the corner near the firehouse at 4000 West Wilcox Street. A fire truck sped out of the firehouse, and the driver lost control. The truck smashed into a stop sign near Williams, and the sign struck and killed her. African-Americans had already picketed this firehouse because it was not integrated. Hearing of Williams' death, 200 neighborhood young people streamed into the street surrounding the firehouse. For two nights, rioting and disorder reigned. Angry youths threw bricks and bottles at the firehouse and nearby windows. Shouting gangs pelted police with rocks and accosted whites and beat them. Approximately 75 people were injured. African-American detectives, clergy, and National Guard members eventually restored order. Mayor Richard Daley then summoned both white and black leaders to discuss the area's problems. An 18-year-old man who had been in the riot admitted he had lost his head. "We're sorry about the bricks and bottles," he said, "but when you get pushed, you shove back. Man, you don't like to stand on a corner and be told to get off it when you got nowhere else to go." Adapted from Any Place But Here. Problems facing urban African Americans. Civil rights leaders had made great progress in the decades following the Montgomery bus boycott, but full equality still eluded many African Americans. Until 1965, the civil rights movement had focused on ending segregation and restoring the voting rights of African Americans in the South. These were goals that could be achieved through court decisions and by convincing Congress to pass new laws. Despite the passage of several civil rights laws in the 1950s and 1960s, racism, prejudice or discrimination towards someone because of his or her race, was still common in American society. Changing the law could not change people's attitudes immediately, nor could it help those African Americans trapped in poverty in the nation's big cities. In 1965, nearly 70% of African Americans lived in large cities. Many had moved from the South to the big cities of the North and West during the Great Migration of the 1920s and 1940s. There they often found the same prejudice and discrimination that had plagued them in the South. Many whites refused to live with African Americans in the same neighborhood. When African Americans moved into a neighborhood, whites often moved out. Real estate agents and landlords in white neighborhoods refused to rent or sell to African Americans, who often found it difficult to arrange for mortgages at local banks. Even if African Americans had been allowed to move into white neighborhoods, poverty trapped many of them in inner cities, while whites moved to the suburbs. Many African Americans found themselves channeled into low-paying jobs. They served as custodians and maids, porters and dock workers, with little chance of advancement. Those who did better typically found employment as blue-collar workers in factories, but very few advanced beyond that. In 1965, only 15% of African Americans held professional, managerial, or clerical jobs, compared to 44% of whites. Half of all African American families lived in poverty, and the average income of an African American family was half that of the average white family. Unemployment among African Americans was typically twice that among whites. Poor neighborhoods in the nation's major cities were overcrowded and dirty, leading to higher rates of illness and infant mortality. At the same time, the crime rate increased in the 1960s, particularly in low-income neighborhoods. Incidents of juvenile delinquency rose, as did the rate of young people dropping out of school. Complicating matters even more was a rise in the number of single-parent households. All poor neighborhoods suffered from these problems, but because more African Americans lived in poverty, their communities were disproportionately affected. Many African Americans living in urban poverty knew the civil rights movement had made enormous gains, but when they looked at their own circumstances, nothing seemed to be changing. The movement had raised their hopes, but their everyday problems were economic and social, and therefore harder to address. As a result, their anger and frustration at their situation began to rise until it finally erupted. The Watts Riot. Just 5 days after President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, a race riot broke out in Watts, an African-American neighborhood in Los Angeles. Allegations of police brutality had served as the catalyst of this uprising, which lasted for 6 days and required over 14,000 members of the National Guard and 1,500 law officers to restore order. Rioters burned and looted entire neighborhoods and destroyed nearly $30 million in property. They killed 34 people, and about 900 suffered injuries. More rioting was yet to come. Race riots broke out in dozens of American cities between 1965 and 1968. It seemed that they could explode at any place and at any time. The worst riot took place in Detroit in 1967. Burning, looting, and skirmishes with police and National Guard members resulted in 43 deaths and over 1,000 wounded. Eventually, the U.S. Army sent in tanks and soldiers armed with machine guns to get control of the situation. Nearly 4,000 fires destroyed 1,300 buildings, and the damage and property loss was estimated at $250 million. The governor of Michigan, who viewed the smoldering city from a helicopter, remarked that Detroit looked like a city that had been bombed. Government. The Kerner Commission. In 1967, President Johnson appointed the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, headed by Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois, to study the causes of the urban riots and to make recommendations to prevent them from happening again in the future. The Kerner Commission, as it became known, conducted a detailed study of the problem. The commission blamed white society and white racism for the majority of the problem in the inner city. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal, it concluded. The commission recommended the creation of 2 million new jobs in the inner city, the construction of 6 million new units of public housing, and a renewed federal commitment to fight de facto segregation. President Johnson's war on poverty, however, which addressed some of the same concerns for inner city jobs and housing, was already underway. Saddled with massive spending for the Vietnam War, however, President Johnson never endorsed the recommendations of the commission. Reading check. Explaining. What was the federal government's response to the race riots in Los Angeles and Detroit? The shift to economic rights. By the mid-1960s, a number of African American leaders were becoming increasingly critical of Martin Luther King's nonviolent strategy. They felt it had failed to improve the economic position of African Americans. What good was the right to dine at restaurants or stay at hotels if most African Americans could not afford these services anyway? Dr. King became sensitive to this criticism, and in 1965 he began to focus on economic issues. In 1966, the Reverend Albert Raby, president of a council of community organizations that worked to improve conditions for Chicago's poor, invited Dr. King to visit the city. Dr. King and his staff had never conducted a civil rights campaign in the North. By focusing on the problems that African Americans faced in Chicago, Dr. King believed he could call greater attention to poverty and other racial problems that lay beneath the urban race riots. To call attention to the deplorable housing conditions that many African American families faced, Dr. King and his wife Coretta moved into a slum apartment in an African American neighborhood in Chicago. Dr. King and the SCLC hoped to work with local leaders to improve the economic status of African Americans in Chicago's poor neighborhoods. The Chicago movement, however, made little headway. When Dr. King led a march through the all-white suburb of Cicero to demonstrate the need for open housing, he was met by angry white mobs similar to those in Birmingham and Selma. Mayor Richard Daley ordered the Chicago police to protect the marchers, but he wanted to avoid any repeat of the violence. He met with Dr. King and proposed a new program to clean up the slums. Associations of realtors and bankers also agreed to promote open housing. In theory, mortgages and rental property would be available to everyone, regardless of race. In practice, very little changed. Reading check. Describing, how did Dr. King and SCLC leaders hope to address economic concerns? Black power. Dr. King's failure in Chicago seemed to show that nonviolent protests could do little to change economic problems. After 1965, many African Americans, especially young people living in cities, began to turn away from King. Some leaders called for more aggressive forms of protest. Their new strategies ranged from armed self-defense to the suggestion that the government set aside a number of states where African Americans could live free from the presence of whites. As African Americans became more assertive, they placed less emphasis on cooperation with sympathetic whites in the civil rights movement. Some African American organizations, including CORE and SNCC, voted to expel all whites from leadership positions within their organizations, believing that African Americans alone should determine the course and direction of their struggle. Many young African Americans called for black power, a term that had many different meanings. A few interpreted black power to mean that physical self-defense and even violence were acceptable in defense of one's freedom, a clear rejection of Dr. King's philosophy. To most, including Stokely Carmichael, the leader of SNCC in 1966, the term meant that African Americans should control the social, political, and economic direction of their struggle. This is the significance of black power as a slogan. For once, black people are going to use the words they want to use, not just the words whites want to hear. The need for psychological equality is the reason why SNCC today believes that blacks must organize in the black community. Only black people can create in the community an aroused and continuing black consciousness. Black people must do things for themselves. They must get money they will control and spend themselves. They must conduct tutorial programs themselves so that black children can identify with black people. From the New York Review of Books, September 1966. Black power also stressed pride in the African American cultural group. It emphasized racial distinctiveness rather than cultural assimilation, the process by which minority groups adapt to the dominant culture in a society. African Americans showed pride in their racial heritage by adopting new Afro hairstyles and African-style clothing. Many also took on African names. In universities, students demanded that African and African American studies courses be adopted as part of the standard school curriculum. Dr. King and some other leaders criticized black power as a philosophy of hopelessness and despair. The idea was very popular, however, in the poor urban neighborhoods where many African Americans resided. Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam. By the early 1960s, a man named Malcolm X had become a symbol of the black power movement that was sweeping the nation. Born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska, he experienced a difficult childhood and adolescence. He drifted into a life of crime, and in 1946, he was convicted of burglary and sent to prison for 6 years. Prison transformed Malcolm. He began to educate himself, and he played an active role in the prison debate society. Eventually, he joined the Nation of Islam, commonly known as the Black Muslims, who were led by Elijah Muhammad. Despite their name, the black Muslims did not hold the same beliefs as mainstream Muslims. The Nation of Islam preached black nationalism. Like Marcus Garvey in the 1920s, black Muslims believed that African Americans should separate themselves from whites and form their own self-governing communities. Shortly after joining the Nation of Islam, Malcolm Little changed his name to Malcolm X. The X stood as a symbol for the family name of his African ancestors who had been enslaved. Malcolm argued that his true family name had been stolen from him by slavery, and he did not intend to use the name white society had given him. The black Muslims viewed themselves as their own nation and attempted to make themselves as economically self-sufficient as possible. They ran their own businesses, organized their own schools, established their own weekly newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, and encouraged their members to respect each other and to strengthen their families. Although the black Muslims did not advocate violence, they did advocate self-defense. Malcolm X was a powerful and charismatic speaker, and his criticisms of white society and the mainstream civil rights movement gained national attention for the Nation of Islam. By 1964, Malcolm X had broken with the black Muslims. Discouraged by scandals involving the Nation of Islam's leader, he went to the Muslim holy city of Mecca, also called Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. After seeing Muslims from many different races worshiping together, he concluded that an integrated society was possible. In a revealing letter describing his pilgrimage to Mecca, he stated that many whites that he met during the pilgrimage displayed a spirit of brotherhood that gave him a new positive insight into race relations. After Malcolm X broke with the Nation of Islam, he continued to criticize the organization and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. Because of this, three organization members shot and killed him in February 1965 while he was giving a speech in New York. Although Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam before his death, his speeches and ideas from those years with the black Muslims are those for which he is most remembered. In Malcolm's view, African Americans may have been victims in the past, but they did not have to allow racism to victimize them in the present. His ideas have influenced African Americans to take pride in their own culture and to believe in their ability to make their way in the world. The Black Panthers. Malcolm X's ideas influence a new generation of militant African American leaders who also preached black power, black nationalism, and economic self-sufficiency. In 1966 in Oakland, California, Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, and Eldridge Cleaver organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, or the Black Panthers as they were known. They considered themselves the heirs of Malcolm X, and they recruited most of their members from poor urban communities across the nation. The Black Panthers believed that a revolution was necessary in the United States, and they urged African Americans to arm themselves and confront white society in order to force whites to grant them equal rights. Black Panther leaders adopted a 10-point program, which called for black empowerment, an end to racial oppression, and control of major institutions and services in the African American community, such as schools, law enforcement, housing, and medical facilities. Eldridge Cleaver, who served as the Minister of Culture, articulated many of the organization's objectives in his 1967 best-selling book, Soul on Ice. Reading check. Describing. What caused a division between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Power Movement? The assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. By the late 1960s, the civil rights movement had fragmented into dozens of competing organizations with philosophies for reaching equality. At the same time, the emergence of black power and the call by some African Americans for violent action angered many white civil rights supporters. This made further legislation to help blacks economically less likely. In this atmosphere, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee to support a strike of African American sanitation workers in March 1968. At the time, the SCLC had been planning a national Poor People's Campaign to promote economic advancement for all impoverished Americans. The purpose of this campaign, the most ambitious one that Dr. King would ever lead, was to lobby the federal government to commit billions of dollars to end poverty and unemployment in the United States. People of all races and nationalities were to converge on the nation's capital, as they had in 1963 during the March on Washington, where they would camp out until both Congress and President Johnson agreed to pass the requested legislation to fund the proposal. On the evening of April 4, 1968, as he stood on his hotel balcony in Memphis, Dr. King was assassinated by a sniper. Ironically, he had told a gathering at a local African-American church just the previous night, "I've been to the mountaintop, I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." Dr. King's assassination touched off both national mourning and riots in more than 100 cities, including Washington, D.C. The Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who had served as a trusted assistant to Dr. King for many years, led the Poor People's Campaign in King's absence. The demonstration, however, did not achieve any of the major objectives that either King or the SCLC had hoped it would. In the wake of Dr. King's death, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1968. The act contained a fair housing provision outlawing discrimination in housing sales and rentals and gave the Justice Department authority to bring suits against such discrimination. Dr. King's death marked the end of an era in American history. Although the civil rights movement continued, it lacked the unity of purpose and vision that Dr. King had given it. Under his leadership, and with the help of tens of thousands of dedicated African Americans, many of whom were students, the civil rights movement transformed American society. Although many problems remain to be resolved, the achievements of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatically improved life for African Americans, creating new opportunities where none had existed before. Reading check. Summarizing. What were the goals of the Poor People's Campaign? Study and writing skill builder. Preparing a bibliography. Why learn this skill? When you write research reports, you should include a list of the sources used to find your information. This list, called a bibliography, allows you to credit the sources you cited and supports the report's accuracy. Learning the skill. A bibliography is a list of sources used in a research report. These sources include books, articles from newspapers, magazines, and journals, interviews, and other sources. There are two main reasons to write a bibliography. First, those who read your report may want to learn more about the topic. Second, a bibliography supports the reliability of your report. A bibliography follows an established format. The entry for each source contains all the information needed to find that source, including the author, title, page numbers, publisher information, and publication date. You should document this information as you carry out your research. If you neglect this step early in your research, you must locate your sources again in order to credit them in your report. You should arrange bibliographic entries alphabetically by the author's last name. Practicing the skill. Review the sample bibliography below from a report on Martin Luther King Jr., then answer the questions that follow. Patrick, Diane. Martin Luther King Jr., New York. Franklin Watts, 1990. Franklin, John H. Jim Crow Goes to School, The Genesis of Legal Segregation in Southern Schools. South Atlantic Quarterly, 57, 1956, pages 225 to 235. Washington, James Melvin, editor. A Testament of Hope, The Essential Writings of Martin Luther King Jr. San Francisco, Harper and Row. King, Jr., Martin Luther. Time for Freedom Has Come. New York Times Magazine, September 10, 1961. 1. Are the bibliography entries in the correct order? Why or why not? 2. What is missing from the second book listing? 3. What features are missing from the second article listing? Applying the skill. Preparing a bibliography. Put together a bibliography of at least 5 sources that you could use for a report on the civil rights movement. Include books, periodicals, and any other sources you wish. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 2 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills.